It probably happens to you all the time. You check out at the store and the clerk asks if you have that store's club or discount card. You get some deals with the card, and the store gets information about what you buy and can start figuring out what you will buy. We're putting more than consumer information out there these days. We volunteer a whole lot online, and of course, plenty is collected. And so more assumptions get made over time about our behavior in the future. That leads us to today's discussion and Patrick Tucker's book, The Naked Future: What Happens in a World That Anticipates Your Every Move. Patrick Tucker is a prolific writer in both fiction and non. He's been published in many magazines, websites, and Encyclopedia Britannica online. He's the deputy editor of The Futurist magazine and director of communications for the World Future Society. The Naked Future, we should point out, is an Amazon Best Book of the Month for March. Patrick Tucker, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
It's good to have you here. The title, obviously, we're not literally naked, but who's naked and in what sense?
Well, it's what's changed. The big transformation that I'm trying to talk about is in the future itself. So we're used to thinking of the future as an idea that we move towards. It gives meaning to our lives, it gives meaning to our actions, but it's not something that we're ever able to grasp. It's not a destination that we're going to hit. There's a lot of opaqueness surrounding it. We spend about 70% of our mental time thinking about the future, but we're not any better at predicting what's actually going to happen in it than were our pre-mammalian ancestors. So we evolved a big portion of our brain called the prefrontal cortex to constantly analyze patterns and extrapolate from those patterns anticipations of what's going to happen next. But we're wrong most of the time, and that's the transformation that I'm talking about with the advent of these enormous data sets and the decreasing cost of computational capability. We're beginning to be able to glimpse areas of the future with a level of clarity that previous generations would have thought impossible. So it's really the future that's naked, both in a broad sense and on a very granular individual level.
When you put it this way, though, I mean, obviously, yes, we do think about the future a lot. We get it wrong a lot, but at least we're looking for patterns and ways in which things repeat. What we're talking about doing is taking the process out of the human brain then and putting it into computers, which obviously have a greater degree of reliability.
Well, we are taking it out of we're going to continue to do it. So we're not removing it from the human brain. We're really sort of augmenting what we do already by globalizing it and increasing the frequency at which it happens, and also especially introducing a lot more stimuli into the entire process. So that's a big sweeping change. But really the fundamental act of prediction is still what's playing out in the brain. We perceive patterns. We're doing this now computationally. And we extrapolate from those patterns a expectation of something that's going to happen. I spent a lot of time talking to different startups that were working in areas of predictive analytics using these very large data sets. And among the most interesting that I talked to, they describe their creation as functioning a lot like the human brain. There's one in particular called Grok. It's started by Jeff Hawkins. He was the guy that started Palm Pilot. And after he started Palm, it's a sort of the first smartphone. It's the precursor to the iPhone. He took a bunch of years and did a deep dive into neuroscience and looked at the way the brain turns memories into an understanding of what's going to happen. It's a creative process. It's a recollection process. And he created a software company that now is attempting to do that based on these really large data streams. And this is shows that fundamentally prediction is still what it always was, but when you multiply the scale at which you're doing it, you're going to have really different outcomes. And it has the potential to change the way we relate, not only to the future, but to one another, to business entities, to government entities, and do so in a really rapid way that I think a lot of people are going to be surprised by, which is sort of ironic because we are talking, after all, about an ever more predictable future.
But does this help us as individuals, or does it help larger entities like the corporations you're talking about and business and potentially government, which we really haven't broached yet?
Well, so this is the thing. It helps both. Right now, we feel like we live in a big data present, right? This is something that I address a little bit in the book. Our understanding of big data is largely informed by news cycles in which we saw, for instance, Target using lots and lots of customer data to anticipate that a certain segment of their buying population was going through a transition. And one particular case stands out. It comes from a New York Times article written by Charles Duhigg that was published in January of 2012, where Target was able to anticipate that one of its customers was about to enter into a second trimester of pregnancy. This is before you start buying lots and lots of baby stuff. And that's key. That's a key area for Target, because Target really wants to sort of snag that customer and bring them into Target a lot more often to change all of their buying habits before they start getting into the habit of buying their baby stuff somewhere else. So it has to predict pregnancy before anybody else. And it did this on the basis of a large correlation analysis. And one of the things that they saw was that people that are entering into this period of pregnancy, they buy, a lot more skin lotion, because pregnancy dries out your skin. You're taking a lot of, you know, the body's moisture for a new life form. And the volume of skin lotion would be unscented skin lotion. So they use this to send coupons out to people that they thought might be potential sort of pregnancy shoppers. And one of these customers happened to be under the age of 18, and her father was opening the mail and saw a bunch of pregnancy coupons. And it turns out that Target had predicted this woman's pregnancy before she had time to tell her father. And so this is how we feel about this stuff right now. We feel like big companies use our data to sort of, you know, triangulate us and to market to us ever more aggressively. And that is going to happen. As we get into the future, we're going to be confronted with a lot more context-aware advertising. But the thing that I try to argue in my book is that the solution to that is actually to produce a lot more data, not a lot less. And that's really the – so there's actually a way to get around this using the data that you create.
All right. More data, more discussion coming up. The book is called The Naked Future, What Happens in a World That Anticipates Your Every Move. Patrick Tucker, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with Patrick and take your phone calls and emails when we return here in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Patrick Tucker. He is the deputy editor of The Futurist magazine and director of communications for the World Future Society. No surprise, the word future appears in the title of his book, The Naked Future, What Happens in a World That Anticipates Your Every Move. All that data collection is going to lead to some predictions being made as well. It happens already. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, and our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. So the example you just gave, I mean, has that happened a lot where you get a situation where, for example, this 18-year-old girl gets sent coupons from Target for her baby stuff, and so basically her father finds out from Target before he finds out from her. Does that happen a lot?
Well, we're going to have that happen a lot more. This is the potential of predictive analytics and marketing when coupled with big data. And the thing about the smartphones that we all carry around with us is that they're the perfect delivery system for marketing of all types that's really tailored not just to the individual, but also what the individual is doing at that time and place. And that's going to become like a lot more frequent, where you're walking by a particular place and maybe you're browsing on your phone while you do it, or maybe you're on looking at Facebook or something while you are out and about, and you're going to see ads that are much more relevant to not only who you are and your circumstance in life, but also what you're doing at that moment. And that's because of the data that we create and that we generate around us. We generate on the order of 1.8 million megabytes of data on a yearly basis. That's enough to fill about like 5 to 9 CD-ROMs a day. And a lot of it is just streaming music and movies, but all of it says something about we, the people that created it, and it's stuff that we create through our smartphones, doing precisely what I just talked about. When we walk around, when we turn on our phone is contacted by a cell base station, and we all know that, but a lot of people don't realize that over the years, that cell base station has been reaching out to a lot of other cell base stations all around it, and they're doing a prediction themselves about where you are and where you're going. And when we create that data, we give that data to our carrier, like Verizon or AT&T. And what those carriers then do is they strip that data of identifying information, and then they sell it to big marketing companies like Axiom, and Axiom uses it to sort of target ads to you. But the degree to which that data is stripped of information that really identifies you, it's a thin line. There's a lot of ways to reattach an identity to sort of, you know, that information. And what they're really trying to sell is access to a demographic group. But you want that demographic group to be as specific as possible. So there's a question of, you know, how anonymous really you can ever be in this Big Daddy universe. So we have feelings about this. We feel a little bit encroached upon. We feel like we're, you know, at the mercy of devices that talk about us in a language we can't hear to people we can't see. But the thing that I wanted to try and help people understand is that this is a reflection of the present and not necessarily the future, because in the same way that all technology really gets cheaper, democratizes, and falls into the hands of more people, in the same way that computers used to be these enormous things that lived in universities and were accessible only to a very small group of sort of military folks and academics, and then became things that sat on people's desktops at work, and now they're things that we carry around in our pocket. The same is true of our data. So just like in the future, very near future, you're going to walk around and you're going to see, as you pull out your phone, depending on the browser you're using or the service you're using or the social network that you're using, you're going to see an ad that's sort of specifically tailored to you and what you're doing. So you also have the potential to use your data to even prevent yourself from falling victim to really coercive advertising. So case in point, there's a great startup called TickTrack, and what they do is they take all the different data streams that you create, your biophysical signals, if you use like a fitness monitor like Fitbit that sort of takes readings of your calorie burn, of your activity, things like that. You can look it up, to link it up to your, like your wallet apps, to Amazon ratings and things like that, and you can see how all of these different data streams that you create interrelate, and you can get a window into your life that really rivals anything that any marketer is able to get, and actually exceeds it, because remember, you're the origin point for all of this data. You're where it all comes from. So you can use that data to, in the future, not immediately, but this is the ultimate goal of these sorts of startups and these sorts of services. In the future, you're going to be able to, when you walk by a place, get a push notification that tells you, not necessarily a marketing message, but tells you the probability that you're going to make a purchase that you're going to regret, or that you're going to receive a future marketing purchase, like a message that you might not necessarily want to take up. And you're going to know more about yourself than really any marketer wants you to know. And so it sort of accelerates. It's an arms race. And then that forces, I think, other companies to kind of partner with consumers more in delivering, not only value, but also empowers consumers to really decline a lot of offers and services that they might otherwise not. And that's because we create this data. And all we have to do is demand, the rise of services that let us access it in a new way. And they're going to rise. Many of them are already springing up. We want them. There's a consumer demand for them. Big data is not just owned by big companies. It's created by people, and so we're going to begin to access it.
When you say big data, is this like big oil or big pharma, the same sense of the word big?
Well, no. So big pharma is like a small handful of companies that get to sort of run the marketplace on pharma, right? And big oil is very much the same way. Big oil is this tiny group of super mega large companies that get to determine huge operational aspects of the market. They don't get to price fix legally or explicitly, though with BP there was an issue of that a couple of years ago. But it's when we think of big data, we're actually thinking about something different. Big data is just it's what I said. It's the data that you make through your interactions. We create information in everything that we do, and it's completely different from big oil or any other sort of like commodity, because unlike oil, the price of the ability to process it, the more of it we create, the price of processing it goes down. This is a big distinction. And also, here's the other thing about it. The more of it we create, the more likely it is to get out there. And that's different from like big oil. And so when we talk a little bit about Target, or for that matter, the NSA, and their ability to hold on to all of this data and really use it against all of us, we're talking in, I think, really 2012, 2013 terms. If you look at the, you know, everything that's happened with the Snowden scandal, with the NSA leak scandal from 2013 beyond, remember, we're not talking about just the NSA and their ability to sort of spy on us and snoop on us. We're talking about the revelation of that capability. You know, Edward Snowden, whatever you think he is, whether you think he's a hero or you think he's a villain, or he's a hero that deserves prosecution or a villain that should be set free, one thing is for certain, history is going to regard him as the most famous systems administrator that ever lived. He was a regular person. He was a regular person that had a particular job that wasn't by far a job that's hard for anybody to get. And he was able to do to the NSA what we feel like the NSA is doing to us. And what this says about big data is that the more of it's collected, the more of it is likely to get out. And that's an environment we all have to live in. And we have to live in it in a way that's actually productive. We don't have the luxury of just sitting around feeling insulted and demanding that time and progress reverse itself, because that's not going to happen. We have to wake ourselves up to the opportunities that this moment in time presents. And the opportunity is this. We create information, everything that we do, and we get to access it if we demand so.
Patrick Tucker is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the deputy editor of the Futurist magazine, director of communications for the World Futurist Society, author of the book The Naked Future, What Happens in a World That Anticipates Your Every Move. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the ways that our data is used for us, with us, against us. Join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area in the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So you're saying it's really a case of the people who, as you're saying, we can't sit around and just, feel annoyed that things have changed so much, but need to be more proactive in managing what is out there. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, absolutely. Oh, and also, if I could just sort of throw in a very quick sort of change. I recently took a new job at a website called Defense One. So I'm the technology editor for a website called Defense One. You can find us at defenseone.com, all one word, but I still write for The Futurist quite a lot. So just wanted to make sure that it was it's very new. It's very brand new.
Okay, well, thanks for the update on the resume.
Yeah. No. It's important because I like the new job, and we're doing some great work here exactly on the sort of national security stuff. But, I think that to get back to your question.
Which was about the managing the stuff that you put out there.
Yeah, exactly. We are, this is our job. This is our job for the next 10 years, is to figure out what it is and to demand the rise of services that let us access it and use it and understand it in new ways. And that job has a lot of different moving parts to it. So even though I am really optimistic about the potential of big data to help us understand ourselves and the world around us, it's not something that just automatically happens, and the naked future is not something that happens without inconvenience to some people, without further incidents of false positives, without big problems. I think that net, the result is great for all of us, for all of humanity. But to decrease the number of times people feel inconvenienced, where people feel as though privacy has been violated, their lives have been violated, we all have to remain vigilant. So even though I think we should be broadly optimistic, I think we also have to take part in this discussion in a really proactive way. I think that it's a good idea to join the Electronic Frontier Foundation, sign up for ACLU newsletters, watch this debate that's playing out right now over the future of the NSA, and play a role. This is really key. If you have the name of your congressman or senator sort of handy, see where they fall on some of these issues about, creating congressional or Senate, more congressional or Senate oversight for the NSA. What are your feelings about it? Your feelings get to be whatever they are, but you should know what they are, why you have them, and what's going on here. And aside from that, also think about when you talk to your phone carrier, for instance, when you look at what your data, how they're selling you services, how they're vending services to you. Understand that there's other people, other startups out there that can also vend services to you that help you understand what's going on with you. And just make a decision about how much of yourself you want to learn about, because this is information that you create. Do you subscribe to like Fitbit or some sort of personal fitness program like that? How do you watch your spending? What's the annoyance level in terms of how much self-monitoring you want to do? These are questions that I think we all want to start asking. And the good news is that as we all begin to ask them more often, services are going to rise to help us understand our data much better.
Let us take a call. We have Priscilla in Neyland, California on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Patrick Tucker, the author of The Naked Future.
Hi. I had a question about where the impulse in business is going to be, because information only really has value, monetary value, when some people hold it and some people want to buy it. If everybody knows it, then it really doesn't have much value. So I would think that, or I shouldn't say it has much value. It has intrinsic value, but it doesn't have marketable value. And so I would think that the impetus would be to restrict access to information from just anybody, and thereby make a marketable product. So I just wondered what you had to say on that.
All right. Thanks, Priscilla.
Yeah, no, I think this is a good point, and certainly we create a lot of information that not everybody that we create that information with, in terms of like phone carriers or whatnot, is exactly anxious to share it all the time with everyone, but we do create it, and it does get shared. And you could really say the same, this is part of the point that I make, you could really say the same thing about computers. Remember when there were only three computers? The people that owned them were like, my gosh, the last thing that we want is for there to be more of these or to open up access to these sorts of things, because that would decrease the premium that we could charge for access to the systems that we have. And next thing you know, people created more of them. They have continued to flood the entire world and create an entirely new 21st century economy. And now we don't worry about this anymore. We trust that the information technology increased in profitability as it increased in abundance. And the same is true of the data that we create through information technology. So you're going to be creating on the order of 44 times as much information in 2020 as you did in 2009. And while, yes, there is clearly a big, there's a big push to not necessarily let everybody in the world see all of that at once, there's also a big push to use all of it, to find correlations across these very large data sets. And in order to do that, you have to expose it. And that's the thing about information. As you begin to collect it, you have to use it. It only takes on its real value when you use it. And when you use it, you're letting some of it go. You're entering into a economical ecosystem that's built around exchange and, to a certain extent, transparency. And so the more of it there is, the more of it is likely to get out in one way or another. And that's really what I'm trying to help people understand, is that, number one, the information that you create isn't necessarily safe, not with anybody that you create it with in terms of a phone company or any computer service or anything like that. And also that means that you get to use it in ways that help you live a little bit better, help you to make decisions smarter. And so that's all I'm really encouraging people to do. But I think she has a really good point. And what we want to do is move the conversation to where I think more and more companies understand that sharing information with users as much as possible is going to improve that relationship with them.
In other words, telling you what they've got on you?
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. So, I mean, there's a lot of different ways you can go on this. It depends on the company and what their mission is, right? And this is what is going to help us understand who we really want to do business with. So case in point, right? Let me give you sort of a good guy, bad guy dichotomy here. On the good guy side, there's some really interesting recent efforts by Nike. They want to partner, if you will, allow me to take that noun and turn it into a verb, which is something I usually don't like doing, but we'll do in this case.
We'll party on with
this. Yeah, right. We'll partner with users to help them optimize a lot of their fitness activities. And through like the Nike Runkeeper app, you can see where you're meeting your goals, where you're not, where you're sort of slipping. Nike really wants you to keep using this app a lot, and they want you to keep using their product a lot, but they also want to help you to understand what you're doing to meet your goals, to continue to do the sorts of activities that help you keep using the app, but also that help you. They want to be with you in partnership on a big objective. Now, contrast that with a company like Harrah's. Harrah's is a casino chain, right? Now, Harrah's has a ton of information on you, too, and Harrah's uses that to target very specific marketing to you. Harrah's can know, for instance, if you go to the casino once a year, or twice a year, you know, what your breaking point is, even like how likely you are to step away from a table after playing a certain amount of hours and losing a certain amount of money. And that's information that they're not exactly anxious to share with you. But because they have to use it, they have to share a little bit of it. If you're losing really heavily at Harrah's and you're approached by somebody who offers you a free dinner club, card, then what they're trying to do is keep you in the casino. And you can make the decision at that point that rather than take them up on that offer and, you know, have dinner in the casino and then go back to your table and lose a whole bunch more money, you can pick yourself up, walk out of that casino, and hit another one down the street, and then that's what they're trying to keep you from doing. So this is information that we create that's used, we can use with companies, that companies use against us, but even when they use it against us, they're still letting it slip just a little bit. And this is something we get to pay attention to a lot more.
Right, so it's really knowing the motivations of the people who are approaching you and trying to work around those if you choose. And that's the big point is the choice. So we'll talk more about this with Patrick Tucker. His book is The Naked Future, What Happens in a World That Anticipates Your Every Move. We're answering that question here on the Jefferson Exchange. You can join us when we come back from this break. Back with Patrick Tucker and your phone calls and emails in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, it's our final segment with Patrick Tucker, the author of The Naked Future, What Happens in a World That Anticipates Your Every Move. All that data that is collected on us, voluntarily or not so voluntarily, well, it's used to predict what goes on, and we can be privy to that information as well, as Patrick is pointing out. You can join this conversation on the Exchange, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, in the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, and our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. I want to come back to some of the real-world examples here about things that go beyond just the consumer purchases and things like that, because you start the book off with an example of your experience with Japan's earthquake early warning system. What happened?
Well, this was rather terrifying, yes. I was covering the relief efforts up in Ishinomaki. It was an area that was particularly hard hit by the tsunami. A couple others that were journalists that were working in Japan at the time felt that the issue with the nuclear power plant, which is really something that was going to play out for multiple years, was overshadowing meaningful coverage of what was going on in places like Ishinomaki that had just been devastated by the tsunami. So we were trying to get up there to see what was going on, because really the Japanese government had no presence up there at that time, as long as like a month after this tremendous, just sort of devastating natural disaster. So that's the backstory. So I was in. I'd just been writing a story up there, and I was with a reporter from Dubai and a couple of Japanese fishermen that were driving us around, and a relief coordinator. And we had just been covering the event. We were driving back to Tokyo, and our route took us within the 80-kilometer evacuation zone that the U.S. government had advised its citizens to stay out of, which was Fukushima. So we were driving very close to a Chernobyl-level nuclear meltdown. And so because of that, and also we were a little bit late, we were driving on this road really, really fast. And everyone else on the road was also driving really, really fast, because it's a meltdown and you should get away from it. So we're on this road and we're driving fast. And all of a sudden, the guy behind me, he was a fireman. He's got this thing on his jacket. It's a great big receiver, and it starts like ringing really loudly, and a bright red light is going off. And he yells, "Oh my God, pull over!" So the two Japanese fishermen that were driving the car, they look at one another, and they pull the car over to the side of the road, not in a way that, you know, is very abrupt, but you know, didn't hurt us. And this is the weird thing. This is the really surprising thing that happened right after that. Every other car on the road, no matter how fast they were going, all did the exact same thing. They all pulled over to the side of the road. And in about, you know, the next 30 seconds, you felt this enormous wave kind of push up the car and bring it slowly back down. And it was seriously like all of a sudden we were on a boat. And this was a 6.0 aftershock. They were having aftershocks that big, as long as a month after the earthquake. So this was a 6.0. And we realized that had we been driving at our previous rate of speed, there surely would have been an accident, and we probably would have crashed. So what this was the early earthquake warning system. It's a network of 4,000-plus sensor stations that are set up all around the country and out into the ocean that detect the what are called the pre-waves in an earthquake. And these are the initial tremors that speak to the size of the later S-waves. And the S-waves are the really big ones. Those are your 9.0s and things like that. So what it was literally, in a very literal sense, the subtitle of the book, this was an environment that was anticipating what was going to happen next. And this is what we're building right now. Is a environment, not just with our smartphones and all of the information that we create through our digital interactions that way, but also in our physical environment with sensors, with cameras, with satellite systems, an environment that is anticipating our every move. And so I felt in that moment that I had seen just sort of like a little glimpse of the future. And as someone that, you know, covers the future, it was pretty thrilling, because that's the thing that you're always looking for.
And thrilling in a good way in this sense, too.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is, I mean, there's so many things we're going to be able to use this information for, is the thing that I would really help like readers to understand. Information is good. More of it is better. We've always felt this way. We're going to be able to use this stuff to avoid a lot of inconvenience, a lot of pain, and a lot of suffering. We're going to be able to use it on a very individual level to avoid sickness in new ways, to feel better, to live better. We're going to be able to use it to really accelerate the way that we learn, to get beyond these sort of 20th century learning mechanisms that really come from the industrial age, that really come from the 19th century. I mean, we're going to be able to change school and learning in tremendous ways. We're going to be able to change the way people meet and interact and just create entire new levels of intelligence in those interactions. And that's what's going to be so exciting, if we can just decide that our reaction extends beyond feeling merely insulted and feeling merely invaded. If we can understand the potential of this moment, then we're going to be much happier.
Let's take another call. Here's Susan in Phoenix, Oregon. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Patrick Tucker. His book is The Naked Future.
Hi there. I have a question. If you're one who assumes this amount of information being gathered about you is annoying or an insult to your place, I know that there's things we can do on our smartphones and our computers to reduce that. Like, we can turn off the GIS, the systems on our phones. We can do things on our computers. Is that something you want to discuss, or just want to put a, that it's all good?
All right. Well, let's pick it up there. Thanks for the call, Susan. Appreciate it. Well, I mean, how much do you advocate people trying to stay off the grid, turn off the GPS on their phones, et cetera?
I keep the GPS on my phone off a lot of the time, because it really eats up your battery life. So I think that that's probably it's a really valid point. Here's the thing. All right. So this is good. At the same time, there's no way to really release yourself entirely from the grid. But yes, there are certainly ways to use it a lot smarter. So, for instance, Pew puts out a lot of reports on how people use the internet, and in the wake of the Snowden scandal, you see a lot more people using virtual private networks or other sort of encryption technology around email to keep a lot more of their data safe. I think this is broadly a good thing. But here's the other thing that Pew report reveals. The people that are most likely to do that are the world's heaviest internet users. These are people that are still creating a lot more data. So if the user makes they can't call all callers users, because we're not all into some gigantic computer, even if we are sometimes in my brain. But the caller makes a fantastic point. There are so many things that we can do to protect aspects of our data at different moments from different parties. But the more of that you do, the more data you're actually creating all of the time. The people that are best, that are most likely to take extra measures to ensure their privacy online, are the heaviest internet users. They are the people that are creating more data. And all I want people to understand is that the more data you create, the more of it you have to use. So just use it.
Well, so in the case of the people who are trying to cover their tracks, as it were, or just not leave a lot of information out there on the internet, I mean, are they developing a profile that says to the people who read the patterns and the computers that read the patterns, this is the person you want to tread lightly with? Or is there some other sort of approach that is taken with people who are protecting their information more?
Well, that's not the only we're not just that one thing, right? These people represent a consumer class for a particular type of product as well. They're probably going to see a lot more people trying to sell them, the highly secure routers, maybe virtual private network services. I mean, you're a consumer for anything. Then you, what you are a consumer for is going to be largely determined by your actions unless by sort of like demographic clusters. So there's no way to fully signal to everyone that you never intend to buy anything at any point in the future, like no matter what. But there are – so I think, you know, one of the good things is that through your actions, you actually do signal all the time that you're not so much in the market for something, that you're not going to purchase things that you might otherwise. Because the companies that are pushing all this marketing, they have you know, lost too when they misdirect advertising. It's part of the reason, you know, since 2011, I think it was Google VP Neil Moynihan said that in the future, you're going to wind up through Google AdWords, through other Google programs, you're going to wind up seeing like 30% less advertising, and it's all going to be more effective. Now, whether or not you want all the advertising you see to be more effective, that's a, you know, certainly a debate worth having. Google has a perspective on that. But certainly, I think we can all agree that we'd like to see 30% less advertising, that we would only like to be subject to advertising that is in line with something we might actually buy. And then we have to have a discussion about, well, why might I buy, for instance, you know, a weekend at Harrah's Casino instead of a weekend jogging with my Nike Runkeeper? Or why Nike Runkeeper and not this other product? And then we can begin to have those conversations amongst ourselves and with the companies that we give money to. But the good news is that as a result of all of this stuff, all of us probably will wind up seeing less advertising anyway.
Let's take another call here. Steve in Eugene, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Patrick Tucker, the author of The Naked Future.
Howdy. Right off the top, I have to admit I am a Luddite. The most sophisticated machinery I own right now is my cell phone. I've been wondering for a couple years now if the internet isn't one of the greatest threats to come down the pike to civilization as we know it. And I'm talking in terms of privacy, I'm talking in terms of freedom, I'm talking in terms of who has the power. I'm talking in terms of a possible, well, I believe for decades that there is a difference between law and order in a police state. And I just see so much abuse happening out there already that it's appalling. And I'm not only talking about the NSA, I'm talking about hackers, I'm talking about the people that broke into Target and so on. You know, and I'm, you know, wondering, since you're in this field, am I totally off base, or are there some actual real grounds for the concerns that I have?
All right. Thanks for the question, Steve.
Yeah, Steve, I think you can probably rest a little bit easier. I mean, my perspective is not that the internet poses a threat to civilization itself any more than do regular people. And because we want to give a lot of this information away. Steve has already told everybody that he's a Luddite, that he owns a cell phone, and that he's extremely skeptical not only of the government but of the commercial sector and the information that they have. And the internet didn't prompt him to share all of that with everybody. He felt like he needed to get that off of his chest. So Steve is his own greatest information leak, because he's human, and so am I, and so are you. And the fact that we created data that Target had and used against us that was then taken by someone else and revealed to everybody else shows to me that we are people that want to create information and use all of it as much as possible. And I don't think that I have yet to see a technology that's been capable of destroying civilization, and we've had some pretty good ones. The ability to communicate and know a lot more about ourselves and one another, that sounds like a one of the least likely contenders for the prize of civilization-destroying technology. But at the same time, Steve's feelings are in line with the way a lot of people feel, and I think to a certain extent the way I feel. We do. We feel we're at the mercy of machines that talk about us in a way we can't understand, to parties we can't see, and it's upsetting. But we can't pretend for a moment that we're going to be producing less information. Steve has a cell phone. He uses it. He likes it. And if you got a smartphone, there's a lot more things you could do with it. And that's the story for all of us. When Gartner and other analyst firm come up with these figures that say we're going to have 44 times as much information in the year 2020 as we did in 2009, this speaks to an inevitability. We're going to do this. We're going to start making more of this information. I mean, we can, a bunch of us can decide that we're Steve's and forego a bunch of information technology and just keep with our cell phones. And that's going to keep that figure from 44 to 39. But it still speaks to an enormous and broad growth that's going to be transformative.
So in the years ahead then, I mean, if you're trying to make sure that you can regulate this, you're talking about managing your information, getting the making sure that you know what the data is that's out there. But, I mean, should we also be occasionally lying about our choices or be just being whimsical and making them? Is it going to change the behavior that leads to the collection of data?
I think so. I think that it already is. I think that we're having a big conversation right now about appropriate uses of this information and where it's appropriate, where it's not appropriate. We're all beginning, I think, to understand that information that's collected about us that's stored in one place is a lot less secure than we thought it was. And this is going to change the way we interact with a lot of these different services. I think you are going to see more people showing, a willingness to take extra security measures in how they interact with this data, but that doesn't mean they're going to be producing less data. That means that they're going to be producing data a little bit more intelligently. And I think that's, broadly speaking, a good thing. I think we're approaching the point where we just don't feel like our big data belongs to somebody else. We're going to feel like it belongs more and more to us. But first, we have to start demanding access to it, changing the way we relate to it.
All right. It's your data. Go ask for it.
Yeah.
The Naked Future, What Happens in a World That Anticipates Your Every Move, is the book by Patrick Tucker. He is one of the editors at The Futurist magazine, or has been, and he's now working for DefenseOne.com. Patrick, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Pleasure to have you. Tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange at 8 o'clock, we'll talk about possible seismic upgrades to buildings in Ashland. We'll talk about Diabetes Alert Day across the country. And then we'll talk to the author of Your Body book. It's something like an owner's manual for the body. All tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer and today's engineer, Charlotte Duran. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Please have a great day.